C notes. Left, 2, 3, 4, and right, 2, 3, 4. 'Cause she just, she knows me, and he knows I'm right. I've been talking to Jesus all my life. It's like,
this is what you do every Monday afternoon, isn't it? Oh, here comes Tonto.
It's just the way I
Wait a minute, I think I got it.
Yeah, now try it without kicking me.
Okay, guys, I think it's time to face up and agree that we just can't dance.
Hello, I'm Tony Banks of Genesis.
I'm Mike Rutherford of Genesis.
Hi, this is Phil Collins in the studio.
When we convened Mike Rutherford, Tony Banks, and Phil Collins in the studio in November 1991 to examine the Genesis album We Can't Dance, we had no knowledge that it would be the final studio project for these three. However, no one was the least bit surprised when individual superstar Phil Collins announced his departure from Genesis in the mid-90s, because the sheer number and remarkable successes of his various solo albums, singles, and tours, not to mention Mike Rutherford's considerable popularity with several Mike and the Mechanics albums, had narrowed any distinction between the solo work and Genesis, at least in the audience's mind. Add to that the fact that Phil Collins had ventured into acting, from cameos in Steven Spielberg's Hook movie with Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams, all the way to leading roles in Buster and Frauds. And you see why it was 5.5 years between Genesis albums by the time We Can't Dance could be completed. With his first solo album, as early as 1979, it was Genesis keyboard player Tony Banks who first started what would become a trend.
Since the end of the Invisible Touch tour, I mean, I've done two records on my own, actually, one of which was called Bank Statement, which came out about 2 or 3 years ago. And since then, I've done another record called Still.
Since then, I've done a couple of Mike and the Mechanics albums. We did the Living Years album, was the first one, back in, I think it was 89. And then the second one, Word of Mouth, Mechanics albums. And also, we did quite a few... gigs, probably 70 Mechanics gigs around the world, mainly in America. So that kept me out of trouble.
Well, after the tour finished, I made Buster, which had various success in varying degrees of success in different parts of the world. I mean, in America, it sort of sunk without a trace, but I got some reasonable reviews, which hopefully will bear me in good stead for the future. But that was a good experience for me to do that. I did But Seriously, and then, you know, we did the big tour, and then there was a Serious Hits Live, which came out a year ago already. Time flies. And that was really just before, I guess that was out in November, and we started this in March, so there hasn't been much time to do nothing, but then that suits me all right, I think.
I don't think we thought it'd be one-off. I think because once you know that once you've started that kind of thing, you've had the... There's something about doing an album on your own that does give you a lot of pleasure, I think, which is sort of different kind of thing. You work with other people. You have a chance to carry ideas right the way through. And I think once you've done it once, it's like sort of an addiction. You'll want to do it again, regardless of how well they do or otherwise. And so once I think all three of us have done a solo record, then I think from then on, you know, and we'd proved that it worked. Because obviously once, you know, Phil's first record was so successful that, he couldn't have done much better. And then the next record... Next Genesis album happened, and that still was working. So we kind of proved to ourselves that you could take the time away from the group and still keep it working.
I think the thing to remember is that we've been thinking about doing solo albums for quite a while. It wasn't something that automatically, just because Phil had these problems and there was a time break, these problems, you know, his little little quirks
don't seem to go away either.
It had been on the cards for a while, and so it was just a natural time to do it. I think the thing to remember is that with groups, it's kind of difficult. You can't start doing solo things and giving the group a rest for like a year or two or three or whatever until you reach a certain level of success. And I guess someone like Steve Hackett kind of left before we got to that stage. You know, there's a certain moment in time when the time is right and okay to do it, and it's not right before that time.
Talk to me. It's drummer Phil Collins who effectively sets the mood on the song. With the steady clicking of his drumsticks at the beginning of the song, he gives the eerie feeling that time is running out. Here's Phil Collins.
It's funny how these things happen because they end up being justified afterwards. I mean, originally, the sound that I had on the drum machine when we wrote the song was a clicking sound, which is just one of the sounds that I'd sampled, and it wasn't a very good sample at all, but it was instead of like a hi-hat part. And then when we came around to putting the drum machine back properly, like with sounds that we wanted to use, and we put real drums on it, I just replaced that sound with hitting a drumstick on a monitor box, a wooden box, you know, and without even really meaning it to sound like a clock. And then you get it back sampled and you hear it back on the tape. And it actually started to sound like a clock. And even before the words were written, it sounded a bit like a legitimate clock. And then the words were sort of as if the time was running out for the boy, you know. So it kind of goes around in circles, really, and it just justifies itself afterwards. But it's I suppose it's supposed to be a clock, and certainly in the video it's depicted as a clock. Lyrically, the time is running out for the boy. I mean, he's fed up with living in a house where there is abuse, be it sexual, physical, or mental. You're not quite sure, and we don't actually tell you in the song what it is. You have to draw your own conclusions from that. And indeed, whether it's him being abused or his mother, but the boy is very very frustrated by living in this sort of tension, and so he decides to leave home. And eventually, he returns, hoping his father will have seen the sense. And seen that sort of what he's been doing wrong. And of course, the father, as in so many cases, I think the father doesn't actually realise what he's been doing, and considers the boy to be to blame for leaving in the first place. And so it goes on, and that's why you end up with quite a few sort of homeless teenagers on the streets, I guess, because they're afraid to go home, you know.
Another track on the album, We Can't Dance, that travels down previously uncharted lyrical territory is the hypnotic Dreaming While You Sleep. As Mike Rutherford, Phil Collins, and Tony Banks explain, the storyline in Dreaming While You Sleep could quite easily have gone down a path even Genesis would have a difficult time pulling off.
It's a good example of how some of the lyrics come together. It's the lyric I did, this being Mike here, but when Phil was singing through with the song, we were rehearsing it, that phrase, dreaming while you sleep, he always sang. And in the chorus, All My Life, a popular phrase for him. And automatically, dreaming while you sleep conjured up a very nice image. The song is about a chap who hits a girl in a hit-and-run accident, basically. He doesn't stop, and his rest of his life is haunted by her, really. She's lying in hospital in a coma, and he goes back and kind of becomes obsessed by her and her welfare. And the idea, you know, are you dreaming while you sleep, or as someone in a coma, you know, are they having thoughts? Are they just vegetable-like? I mean, really, what state is their mind in? And it's quite an interesting topic.
It just goes to show, because, like, Dreaming While You Sleep pointed Mike in that direction, whereas Tony used to think I was singing Gene Wilder's Socks, which actually could have pointed the song in a completely different direction, so we should be grateful that it went in the direction
Gene
it did.
Wilder's Socks.
All right, I think Gene Wilder's Socks would have been an interesting concept, yeah.
In and out of darkness, in and out of sleep, trying to keep my hands upon the wheel. I never saw the corner in the driving lane. I never saw her step into the street. Dreaming while you sleep. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Tony Banks of Genesis.
I'm Mike Rutherford of Genesis with Redbeard.
Thanks, guys. I was curious about the effects of outside projects from Collins, Banks, and Rutherford, so I asked Phil Collins if their parallel solo careers lengthened or shortened the life of Genesis.
I think it's lengthened the shelf life, if anything. I think without these outside projects or the ability to do those outside projects, I think it may have resulted in someone saying, well, listen, I want to do something else. And if we'd have said, well, I'm afraid it's the band or it's something else, what do you want to choose? And I'm sure that maybe we'd have had a situation whereby the Genesis would have been wound down, you know, but we've never talked like that to each other, and certainly no one else outside the band would ever dream of coming up with such a suggestion. So in that respect, even though there's been 5 years since the last album, I think, which is actually not because we didn't want to work together for 5 years, it just happened to have... That's the way things have turned out. I mean, it actually doesn't really seem like 5 years, to be quite honest. I mean, it's incredible how time does whiz by you. But, you know, it's definitely a reason for keeping Genesis together. I mean, I think we do the things with the three of us which we cannot do on our own. I mean, we sit down in a room when we wrote this album and the last two albums completely without anything prepared. And we sit down and we just improvise and improvise. And that is, although we improvise separately on our own at home for our own records, when there's three of you in a room doing it, it's very sort of fulfilling to come out at the end of a day with gone in with nothing and coming out with what could be the germ of a great song or a great piece of music. And that's something that we can't do on our own, and so it's a good enough reason for keeping the band together. But I think it's, in answer to your question, it's definitely lengthened the shelf life.
Mike Rutherford did tell me he's always had a fear of carrying something past its natural finishing point. I asked Phil Collins to comment.
We don't do a lot of philosophizing about, you know, what the band should be doing or what the band should do or couldn't do or can't do. I think if we try not to talk too much about it, because I think that's when you start painting yourself into corners, and because you said something, you don't really want to not do it. So we don't really discuss it, to be honest. And I think what makes it exciting, actually, is the fact that obviously 5 years is the longest time we've ever been away, but with the last three or four albums of Genesis, there has been so much happening in between that when you come back, it's almost like being in a new group each time. It's the same people, but so much has gone on that, you don't get a chance to get bored with it. And I suppose if we were to go back to that situation whereby all the solo careers were sort of taken away from us, or the outside projects, whatever they may be, you may end up with a point where we would get stifled and maybe a little stale, and then you get that situation what you're talking about, Mike's quote, you know.
With its focus on the problems of homeless people, the song Tell Me Why by Genesis turns out to be kind of a distant cousin, lyrically, to the Phil Collins number one song, Another Day in Paradise. Unfortunately, though he's covered the subject a couple of times now, Phil Collins is no closer to any answers.
It's, you just sort of pose the questions, you know, you don't really come up with it. I mean, I think that's all rock music anyway, I mean, can hope to do. I don't think one can hope to sort of answer any questions. I mean, that obviously they're not simple questions, so they can't be answered very easily. I mean, the lyric for this came about, we were going home at night and sitting, you know, to our families when we were writing the album, and we'd sit down and have dinner and you're sort of watching the news on the TV, and there was a couple of weeks when everything was happening as the Iraqi war had finished and the Kurds were on this mountain, and it was just, people seemed to be ignoring them, and people were dying, and there were kids, mothers holding their kids, crying, and it was on a camera, it was on film, and there we were eating dinner. I mean, it's just, of course, this stuff happens, you know, and but you can't help but be moved by it, and especially when, you know, your little girl starts crying because she sees the kids on the television crying, so you start getting involved in it, and you just think, why isn't somebody doing something? And I tend to write songs, you know, if I feel that thing. And especially if you've already started off down that road with a lyric, which Tell Me Why's lyric was at that early stage, you tend to sort of try and hammer the nail on the head a bit more. I mean, I've certainly got no answers. I mean, it's too big a question. You try, you know, we try to do our bit on the tour with the homeless, but all you can do is raise people's awareness so that when they go out of the stadium and they look and they see these people, that they don't just maybe just... they do something about it. Maybe they'll go and give a bit of money to their local help, their homeless shelter. Who knows, you know? I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
If you take the tears from crying eyes, will the hurt just disappear? Put a weapon in the hands of a frightened man, will he show no fear? So you stand.
Sky, should the rules have to change?
That's Genesis, with a lyric written by Mike Rutherford.
It's an interesting thing. I think it seems to be emerging now a little bit, and it's not quite right, as if the other song, Tell Me Why, is Phil the caring, humane person, and there's me, that mean old rat, saying, hey, guys, it's the way it is, shut up. It's not true at all. I think, in a way, it's just trying to... Two things, really. One is to sort of say the fact that it's important that people realise that in life there are highs and there are lows. An example someone mentioned the other day is there was a Twilight Zone, apparently, where someone was a gambler and he died and went into heaven, and in heaven he always won every time. And he got pretty fed up, you know. If you don't lose, there's no fun in winning. So it says that point. It also kind of, I think I'm trying to reassure people a little bit. I'm not saying they shouldn't try and readjust the imbalance in the world, especially with people's standards of living and health and that kind of thing. But it's saying you should try, but just it's a reassurance almost that to a degree you'll never get it right, because there's just a natural balance that way. And you should worry, but not go crazy with the worry.
Hello, I'm Tony Banks of Genesis.
I'm Mike Rutherford of Genesis with Redbeard.
Thanks, guys, and welcome back in the studio for a look at We Can't Dance. The very first time I heard the title, We Can't Dance, it occurred to me that it sounded like the punchline of a joke. I asked Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks of Genesis if that was the case.
Not entirely. I mean, I don't get asked to dance very often. The title really came from, well, the first thing you do when you look for a title is to see what song titles might be suitable. And they had the song title, I Can't Dance, and We Can't Dance was a nice sort of sounding statement, and I guess it does say a little bit about the fact that in terms of what's going on around the world with an awful lot of dance and rap music, I suppose, we're saying we don't do that. We're not that kind of a band. We're Genesis and what we are. So there's a little comment there. Also, I think it ties into the album cover. We can justify anything, no problem. Whereas, if you haven't seen it yet, there's two figures, a man and a boy, and I suppose We Can't Dance also suggests that a lack of communication between the two people.
But if we'd had a different cover, we could have justified that too.
We're very good at that.
Hot sun beating down, burning my feet just walking around. Hot sun making me sweat, gators getting close, hasn't got me yet. Standing here
The most sparse and stripped bare arrangement of a Genesis composition since Man on the Corner a decade earlier. In contrast to the lighthearted title song, Since I Lost You blends a melancholy melody with heart-wrenching lyrics, made even more touching by the true-life tragedy of Connor Clapton, the 4-year-old son of Phil Collins' good friend, Eric Clapton.
The lyric, on first looking at it, you know, you'd think it was a love song or about a relationship that's gone wrong, you know. But in fact, the song was written, in my head anyway, about Connor, which was Eric's little boy that had that tragic accident. And I wrote the lyrics. Some of the lyrics actually came when we were playing the song the day after it happened. And it was kind of very fresh and very vivid in my mind. And then I sort of took those lyrics and I just wrote the song from what I felt, but also what I felt that Eric felt. So some of the lines actually were from conversations that we had together about what happened. So without making the whole thing sound very morose, I mean, it was actually a song that was about that situation.
It seems in a moment your whole world can shatter.
By Phil Collins after the death of Eric Clapton's little boy, Connor. That's Genesis with Since I Lost You from the album We Can't Dance. The album turned out to be Phil Collins' last studio creation with his mates Banks and Rutherford, peaking at number 4 on the album chart. These three Englishmen, who spend a lot of time in America and have considerable business interests in the U.S., wrote a song about a curiously American phenomenon, the TV evangelist.
From a European point of view, you know, we find it amusing and quite amazing that that these guys, some of them anyway, and there's not, we can't tar everyone with the same brush here, but some of them actually stand there preaching one thing and actually doing another, and standing there and fleecing people and asking for money to build this, to build that in the name of the Lord, you know, and actually the money's not going where it's supposed to be going. I mean, none of us are religious people sitting around the table here, but I mean, we all have some kind of respect for religion. But it just doesn't seem that some of these guys do. And so this was really a sort of satirical jab at those that know, you know.
Do you have television evangelists in the UK, or is it this an American anomaly?
It's an American thing. But, you know, I think a lot of European... I think most English people are sort of aware of the phenomenon. They don't quite understand it. But well, it's really an Englishman's reaction, I think, to seeing these things when you go to America. Because I must admit, when I first went there, which is obviously many years ago now, but... when I first came across a TV evangelist, it was sort of, I didn't realize it was serious. I thought it was a comedy show I was watching. And having watched it for about 10 minutes, I suddenly realized it wasn't. And I found it extraordinary. I didn't know quite what to make of it already, because the whole wave presentation was so alien to the way that religion had been sort of forced down my throat when I was young, which was also somber. But it just didn't seem to ring true to me. It just seemed to me the whole thing was being done as you would expect a TV program to be done, which was a lot of faking it and all the rest of it. And I really found it very difficult to take it seriously. And I think we all responded in a kind of similar way to it. And so this song is a sort of Englishman's response to the TV evangelist.
Question why I'm smiling.
obviously you have those little hooks that you want to, you know, you've written, and you want to sort of elaborate upon those to make a story out of it, really. And I had a book at home called Navvies, which doesn't mean anything to Americans, I know, but the word Navvy is, I think, short for navigator, you know, navigating your way across a piece of land in terms of building. And they call these groups of men Navvies that built the railroads in England. And of course, unlike America, we've got lots of hills. And, you know, there's not, it was a very slow, laborious process of, if rather than go round the hill, you had to blast your way through it. So it was a very, it was a huge undertaking, and a lot of people died doing it, because there was very, very slack safety precautions. And there were young kids killed because they were in charge of, you know, they'd just be picked up in the towns that they were passing through, casual labour. And it was one of the sort of things that very few people think about. You know, they go on a train in England and they don't really think about how it got there. But in fact, it was the book, anyway, that I read, which sort of related on a par with the pyramids in terms of the amount of earth moved and sort of people that it took to build the thing. So it was an interesting idea, really. Interesting. I looked at it from a view of someone that left home, left his family behind him to go off and do this work because he didn't have any other job, and how it kind of gradually made him very hard and hardened to the whole accidents that he was seeing around him, when people were being blown to pieces by sort of misplacing explosives in rocks. And in the end, you know, you come out with the feeling that these breed of men that developed over this period of years that they took to build the railroads, so will never be seen again, you know, because they're a dying breed. They have actually died out now.
Leaving my family behind me, not knowing what lay ahead, waving goodbye as I left them in tears, remembering all we'd said. I looked to the sky, I offered my prayers, I asked him for guidance and strength, but the simple beliefs of a simple man lay in his hands and on my head. Still they wanted more. We sweat and we toil, good men lost their lives, don't think they knew what for. I sold them my heart, I sold them my soul, I gave everything I had, oh, but they couldn't break my spirit, my dignity. Can you
lost itself. No one knew how many had died. All around there were broken men. They'd said it was safe. They'd lie. You could hear the cries. You could smell our fear. But good fortune that day. Hard to find.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Phil Collins and Mike Rutherford. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and visit inthestudio.net.